From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in early 2012. A food blog showed up on Tumblr without much fanfare. The blog focused on vegan recipes designed to convince people to eat healthier foods and have more energy. The difference between this food blog and most was the tone. The blog called itself Thug Kitchen. It used colorful language laced with profanity. The recipes were real, and later that year, the actress Gwyneth Paltrow was on The Rachel Ray Show. Now, Paltrow was asked about how to improve your diet. She, of course, has written about her own habits in the past. So she told the audience a few things, and then Gwyneth Paltrow on The Rachel Ray Show said this.
This is my favorite thing I've discovered recently. There is the most incredible Tumblr page called Thug Kitchen. And it's like a gangster vegan chef. It's the best.
That is hilarious. Awesome.
It's brilliant. So I would check that out.
Oh, my God. That is awesome.
As you might imagine, that set Thug Kitchen on fire. No one knew who was behind the food blog, but demand for recipes exploded. The creators produced more content. And earlier this year, they announced they were releasing a book in the fall. Last week, in preparation for their book tour, the creators of Thug Kitchen revealed their identities. They are Michelle Davis and Matt Holloway, a white couple from Hollywood. That brought a deluge of accusations of cultural appropriation, even racism. Some argue that Davis and Holloway are profiteering from the appropriation of black culture. One critic called it digital blackface. Then there was a backlash to the backlash, with supporters of Thug Kitchen saying, hey, it's all in good fun, or the term thug shouldn't have a black connotation. Earlier this week, Davis and Holloway had to cancel a book signing in San Francisco after protests and threats, but they are carrying on with other book events, and many bookstores are saying this is now an opportunity for a community conversation. So this hour, we're hosting a community conversation on what exactly cultural appropriation is. Does Thug Kitchen qualify? What about wearing a headdress to a Washington Redskins game? What can we learn from all of this? My guests for the hour are Dina Swanson, associate professor in the Warner School of Education at the University of Rochester. Dina, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Vertus Robinson is here. He's an assistant professor of history and African American studies at Monroe Community College. Vertus, nice to see you.
Good afternoon.
All right, let me, before I even get to whether this is a cultural appropriation, let me tell our audience, if you happen to be listening online or you're at work, you can check out Thug Kitchen for a little background. I should warn you, it is filled with profanity. Many people, again, find it funny. It might not be suitable for work if your superiors don't like big, bold, lettered profanity. So there's a bit of a background. Professor Swanson, you've seen it now. Is it cultural appropriation?
There's a framework that's used in the way they present their materials that suggests that they have certainly drawn from a group, in particular in this case an African-American group, and represented that framework in what they presented for gain, for economic gain in particular.
So in your view, intentional or not, it looks like yes.
It looks like a yes.
Okay, Vertus, same question for you. Is this cultural appropriation?
I would say yes. And the history behind it, I wouldn't call it a modern day blackface, but it's around the same lines. It really, really is. Is it comedy? Yes. Is it for entertainment purposes? Yes. Now it's for, you know, economic gain. So I would say yes as well.
Okay. And we will invite your voice in this conversation. We've already have a lot of comments on Twitter. You can join the conversation there, at Evan Dawson. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. My initial reaction in seeing sort of brief interviews with Davis and Holloway is that I don't think they entered this maliciously. But I think maybe out of a position of ignorance about what cultural appropriation is. Professor Swanson, what do you think?
I don't think they had a sense in terms of what the impact would be of naming their book what they have, or even their blog. There is a vilification associated with the word that typically is associated with American black males. And their wording further perpetuates the stereotypes. And so there's an oppositional framework that they may have thought would have been funny, would have been cute, would have suggested that having an orientation for vegans opposing, being oppositional, if you will, to meats and things that are dairy-based. But the framework that they use really does draw on a stereotype that vilifies African-American males.
Do they get any kind of a pass for ignorance to that subject, Vertus? And do you accept that they were probably ignorant as opposed to malicious?
They get no pass.
Well, she spoke for me. They don't get a pass.
Dina says no pass.
Do they get a pass? I would say in this day and age, no. I mean, come on. Even though we've seen this time and time again, I'm thinking about in Living Color right now, and how they would have the sketch More Money, and it was comedy, but they would act. I mean, they would speak as though they were thugs, but they were it was a show where they were selling things that they had stolen. And it was comedy. I mean, and the show kept on going, and I'm sure that people, you know, protested against that because it's a vicious cycle, you know. Even though, you know, they in Thug Kitchen, I was reading it and I could hear someone saying this, or I can hear a black male voice out on the street, probably in my own neighborhood, you know, that could have written this. I mean could have wrote that, but it wasn't. And so it's for me, there is a deceptive quality to it, but this has been going on from the beginning of this country as far as entertainment is concerned, to, you know, make fun of the other and someone that that is outside of a productive member of society, and to make jokes and say. And, you know, for humor, and that's large part of American comedy. It really is, and it's historic, historical. I mean, that was.
But that doesn't make it okay.
No, it doesn't, right. Because that gave license for Jim Crow. It really did. And then you had, you know, black performers doing blackface, and then you have stuff like White Chicks. I mean, White Chicks are almost like the same venue as this is, but it's almost the opposite. So to me, it's still a vicious cycle that this is continuing to go on. And when we learn that this is inappropriate in this day and age.
Okay, but we already have some listeners who are dissenting from what the professors are saying. And let me get some of their comments in here, because I think that this will help the conversation unfold in a number of different venues. First of all, here's Jake writing and says, although I think the Thug Kitchen site is a bit in bad taste, before people jump off the cliff of outrage, they should look up the origins of the word thug. The word is borrowed from Hindi and has some interesting history, a far cry from how most people think of it in modern America. Then he says, anyone thinking that acting thug is, quote, acting black, has some deep-seated racial stereotypes of their own. There are a couple different points there. Let me start with the history. Do we need to look at the history of the word thug?
I think there is some validity to look at the history of a word, but more important to look at the way that the word is used now. Is my point. In Thug Kitchen, it wasn't a Hindu kitchen. There's no Indian food that's a part of this kitchen, even though it is vegan. The thug is when you see it, I mean, right now, and not 100 years ago or when it was created, the word, but when you see thug now, there is a visual representation of inner city urban black man on the street or in jail. And then there comes the accent, there comes the words, there comes the profanity, every other word type thing.
Occasionally, the writing on Thug Kitchen also has incorrect grammar,
right?
These kind of things.
And unfortunately, it may be some of the same conversations or same dialogues as you hear on the streets. So that's why I said it's a vicious cycle, because it is perpetuating. And it's not, and I'm not going to say a lifestyle or anything like that, but it's perpetuating it, and that stereotype, and especially when you're not of that culture, and you're not of that community, and that's my problem with it. But at the same time, we have freedoms here, and also there are no real censoring of the internet. And you have a choice whether you want to go to a website or not, or whether you want to buy a Thug Kitchen cookbook or not.
Now, Dina, when it comes to the history of that word thug, to Jake's point, do you agree with Professor Robinson in that what matters is the modern connotation, not the historical?
it would be nice if people understood the histories of words that we often use, but typically when we use them, we're not referencing a historical context, we're referencing a contemporary framework. And the word thug is currently used in a contemporary orientation that suggests vilification, that suggests demeaning of a group. And so the history of it, while there's relevance to understanding it and how it's currently used, words change in terms of how they are used over time. And right now that word is not used in the same way it was historically presented.
The word thug right now does have a serious racial tinge to it.
Without question. Without question it does.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think it's probably hard to argue that point, but then there's this comment from a reader who did not want to be identified. Okay, but here's the comment. White people have been borrowing, and by the way, this person who's writing is not white. White people have been borrowing from black culture for decades. Think Elvis, think jazz, think Backstreet Boys. So having Thug Kitchen borrow from thug culture is the same thing. Look at popular phrases, you go girl, word up, hey man, I feel you, you da man, etc. These have been adopted by whites and nobody seems to care. It's not racist, it's cultural blending. Professor Swanson?
It's more appropriation than cultural blending. People are not integrating their own cultural histories and orientations in how they use these words, and how they use the phrases that are integrated in. There's not a drawing from their own histories and using it. They're actually taking it from another group and using it. That's not what I would call a blending.
Professor Robinson.
I agree. It's a blend if it is integrated into your own culture, into your own lifestyle. But when it's imitated,
actual integration versus imitation is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
That's correct.
I mean, it's almost, you know, almost as though to really demean it or to profit from it. I mean, yeah, and historically this has been going on, like, of course, like Elvis, you know, you ain't nothing but a hound dog. Elvis did not create that. Everyone should know that Big Mama Thornton did.
By the way, that song itself has been played on this broadcast recently, and that is a better version of Elvis's. I just wanted to say.
Oh my gosh, it is.
It is a great version. I think it's 1953.
It has so much blues and soul to it.
But yes, but this listener is saying Elvis wasn't criticized for cultural appropriation.
Not during his day, but in my classes he is.
Yes.
Okay. So you're saying we're missing. She's saying Backstreet Boys aren't criticized, and there's plenty of what they do that you might say is cultural appropriation. I don't know if that's a fair charge either. But let's define it. Then let's define what cultural appropriation really means. Let me start with Professor Swanson. When we hear that term, what do we mean by it?
My sense is that we're talking about taking something that's used as a defining attribute of a particular group and claiming it as our own. And so it's like me taking something from another culture and presenting it to my culture as though it's mine. And that is, in fact, taking something from another group.
As in a white couple writing a food blog in language that seems to be borrowed from a different culture that is not their own.
Correct.
For the sake of laughs, attracted viewership, maybe even book sales.
Right.
And, you know, there's an expression that's saying that imitation is the highest form of flattery. So, I mean, you can look at it from that pinpoint and that standpoint as well, that, you know, this imitation could be, you know, flattery. Or maybe that's what they're saying.
That's what maybe they think.
That's what they think. Like,
if it was imitation, that was a positive form of invitation.
Playing devil's advocate.
Right?
I agree with you. But I could see it from the other way too. Well, why are you concerned about this? This is, I mean, we like this. We like this lifestyle. We like the and we see it on television all the time, and it's very marketable. So we're just, you know, part of the American dream.
Now, so here are some other questions we have from listeners about what cultural appropriation is. They asked about wearing fans of the Washington Redskins wearing headdresses to Washington Redskins games. Now, by the way, we could do a whole hour on the term Washington Redskins still somehow being a sports team name, but let's actually look at fans who wear headdresses to the games. Is that cultural appropriation?
They're given a pass for doing that kind of, presenting that kind of behavior because there's an orientation within the industry, the football industry, that says it's okay. I think they should reflect greater awareness of what they're doing and the impact it has. We don't have enough conversations that really infringe on people's sense of awareness and their social consciousness. So people do things that feel appropriate and that allows them to think that they're doing something that's imitating and accepted, when in fact it's creating harm in ways that they don't have a clear sense of at all.
Yeah, I've thought for a long time that supporters of the term Washington Redskins, by and large, are not what you would, and again, this we could get really meta in discussion here. I would say most supporters of the term are not racist, or at least I think all of us have a little tinge of racism in us. But the bottom line is I think most supporters are not supporting a term for any racist reason, but the term is racist. Can you support a racist term but not be a racist? You understand?
Can you support a racist term and not be aware that that's what you're doing?
Yes.
Yeah. You can do that.
Yeah, I think that's probably the status here.
In today's point and in today's time, there's too much information available to us to not be more aware of what's occurring. And so for the couple that created the blog that's now authors of this cookbook, there's a sense from my orientation that they should have had more sense of awareness, a greater social consciousness around what the impact, not only of the word, but of how they framed their recipes, for example, in borrowing from another group. It's not that the word thug is a word that I think the African-American community wants to embrace as their own. The issue I have is that it's associated with profiling. It's associated with negative imagery. And people across America don't differentiate. They just use the term indifferently. And it further perpetuates an orientation that's not beneficial for members of the community, and in particular, young black males.
Professor Robinson, when people go to the Washington Redskins games wearing headdresses, they often say, hey, I'm doing it to honor that culture.
Yeah, and that's what Jim Crow, when he was, Tommy Daly Rice, when he was singing and dancing, he was honoring, black slaves, males, and singing and dancing, and, I'm Will About Our Jim Crow. I mean, and that sprouted off a movement that then became the name to put African Americans in second-class citizenship and deny them rights. So, I mean, when I look at that and I look at this, I'm, that's why I teach history, because I was like, we have to understand where all this comes from, and that if we do not realize what we're doing, we're going to keep on doing this. So what we're doing, I mean, for as people who are, urban black males or who are quote-unquote thugs and who also call themselves thugs, guess what? We're putting them in a category of second-class citizenship, and we're not really realizing that we're doing that.
If you want to join the conversation, you can do so. And I see the phone starting to light up. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. I think there's probably, it's probably fair to ask, well, let me ask a listener's question before I even get to my next point. A listener wants to know if belly dancing is cultural appropriation. Virtus.
Belly dancing, is it cultural appropriation? That's a tricky one, because for one thing, I cannot speak to the origins of belly dancing without looking it up. Mm-hmm. That's something I will have to research, where that really comes from and what culture that comes from, and then how it's being used.
But I don't think it's meant to belittle. I actually think it's meant to either entertain in an authentically grounded way, or to actually, I know people who get into belly dancing to lose weight, that kind of a thing. So I what do you think, Professor Swanson?
I don't know much about belly dancing to be able to speak to that.
Yeah.
So my only orientation with respect to it has been its use in the classes where salsa classes, those kind, for not even for entertainment, but for weight loss. And the orientation even in there has to do with the cultural foundation of it. And so a lot of times teachers who are presenting it will talk about some of the cultural history, but I can't speak to whether or not it's cultural appropriation or not.
And then what about tap dancing, right? I guess, because I can speak to that, then over belly dancing. But tap dancing, you know, started with black black culture. And then, well, tap dancing it is. But there were other forms of that style of dancing from the Irish and things of that nature. But then you see the most people that you saw, the early tappers that were making money with it were white. Of the Fred Astaire, you know, that type of thing, and not Mr. Bojangles or, you know, Bill Robinson. So yes, I would say that something like belly dancing or tap dancing would be more flattering than. But at the same time, when it's used to make a profit at the expense of a group that that started it. Then I think we have a problem, and I think that we have a problem with this because people who with
Thug Kitchen,
yeah,
okay,
because it is a part of our culture, no matter if we like it or not. It is a part of the culture. It is out there. It is on the streets, and now it's in the media. But the people who are living that are not profiting from it. But people who are part of the dominant group, part of the privileged group, are profiting from it, are becoming famous now, getting shout-outs from Gwyneth Paltrow. I mean, and people who are living it are not. So there's a disconnect here, and it's been going on since the beginning.
And I think that captures the orientation with respect to what is culturally what is cultural appropriation.
Yeah,
it's taking something from another group and benefiting from it without giving recognition to or supporting in some ways the group that you're taking something from.
Exactly.
And so even with respect to the caller who was asking about belly dancing, it would be a framework for determining whether it's cultural appropriation or not.
And if we're going to get to the phones in just a second. If you're waiting on the line, we're coming to you next. Misty on Twitter says, so it's only appropriation if it's a negative connotation to those who might be offended by it? That's what it sounds like based on the discussion. I'm not exactly sure that's...
That's not this. I don't think that's the framework. In this case, in terms of Thug Kitchen, it's a negative connotation. But much like the orientation of tap dancing was fun. And so it wasn't negative, except that it was used in a way that did not honor the culture that it actually was taken from.
And a follow-up comment from a listener who commented earlier. I'd like to point out, driving through the inner city, I see plenty of white, Latino, and even a few what you would call, Asian, what you would call thugs. I never really associate the word thug strongly with skin color. I'm curious just how strongly associated with African Americans the term really is, based on polling rather than assumptions I'm hearing on the show. I don't know if any polls have been taken on this, so that's going to be hard to sort of answer. But his point is it really a term that the African American community associates, you know, with some sort of a connotation of their culture or negatively or a stereotype of their culture? The word thug.
I'm debating on that. So I don't know if we would, quote, own it as our own, but it does reflect a subgroup of the African-American community. And you can find, as some have posted, that you can find what might be considered a thug in other cultural groups as well. But there's an orientation within the broader society to identify young blacks who fit a particular profile, if you will, as being thugs.
And if you think about the man who killed police officer Daryl Johnston had a tattoo that said thug. And I would certainly think most people in any community would not want to tattoo that word on themselves. That probably speaks to some of the problems he's had in his own life. But again, it's a term that hurts the black community, Professor Robinson?
To me, I'm debating about this too, because for one thing, the word thug and the thug life and the thug lifestyle and everything came when hip hop went that way.
Mm-hmm. Right. Probably 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, and so for as an historian, like right now, what's going on culturally, I want to be a fly on the wall because years from now, we'll be able to look back and see, okay, what this was, what is this, and how far will it go? Right now, media and videos and music industry is really perpetuating this and really marketing this and saying, you know, and really. And young men and women are watching MTV, are watching watching these stars and cribs, and look how they're living. And most of those people who are so-called thugs are not living real thugs' lifestyles. I'm sorry, but if you are a thug, or you're in the image of a thug is being on the streets and you're hustling and things of that nature, most of them don't even do that on a daily basis. They're in their mansions, and so this perpetuation of this stereotype is to me, and I hate to say that, is driving, is bringing the Black community down, because we have yet to see what it's actually going to do.
All right, one more online question, and before we get to the phones, Roy writes in to say, the issue of cultural appropriation in regards to Thug Kitchen is paranoia and political overcorrectness. Please ask your guests the specific harm this is causing. Are they worried these people are stealing the great posture of being a thug? Oh, please. I think it betters the world with comedy and blending of societal culture. And he says, by the way, can a non-Latino open a Mexican restaurant?
So he says we have comedy and blending of...
Well, he's saying, first of all, he's saying, how does this specifically cause harm is the question. That's the question.
I've already said it.
Go ahead. Perpetuating
a stereotype that is not conducive to our society. I mean, and productive part of our society. It's not. And the issue that for this Thug Kitchen thing, I'm not saying, oh, like, pull it off the shelves or pull it off the web. Again, we have freedoms. We can write this stuff. I don't think we're arguing here that, you know, take it off. We shouldn't. What I'm arguing is that when will we learn that what this has done, and what kind of things that this will do? When will we get to the point where we're not going to market from another culture?
But the specific harm that you've said is essentially it perpetuates a stereotype about one race, while people who are pushing that stereotype are profiting. That's the harm that Roy is asking about. Is that a fair characterization, Professor Swanson?
That is a fair characterization, and I would add that what we're talking about right now, in a month from now, the conversation will be about what is the thug. And so the association between the title of the book and the names of the recipes within the book, for example, there's a sense of congruency between the language in the book, the title of the book, that becomes associated with a group of people, not with the book. So over time, it's still that language and the title of the book being thug that we associate with the group. And so the harm becomes the implication in how we associate the wording, the title, with a group. And so in the future, when individuals run across someone that they identify or consider to be, quote, a thug, they associate certain things with it. They won't associate it with a cookbook. And so it's the negative imagery that comes with the title that creates the harm. And our youth, in turn, are having to be protected by those who are profiling them as being this imagery associated with the word. And that's where the harm comes in.
But Roy also follows and says, can a non-Latino open a Mexican restaurant?
Yes. You can open any kind of restaurant that you want. That doesn't mean it's going to be successful. I mean, especially if it's not authentic, if it's not giving honor to the culture that you're representing. So, and if it does, it can be a very successful restaurant. Will it be popular within the Latino community?
I don't know,
probably,
man.
Not.
Olive Garden. Olive Garden is not exactly Italian food, but millions of Americans think it is.
Yeah.
Right.
But I think that we're hearing a lot of questions on those lines. And I understand, I think there's very well-meaning questions here. So let's do this. Let's get a 60-second break. If you're on the phone, we're coming to you next as we continue the conversation about what is cultural appropriation, what does it mean, and what can we learn from it. Our guest this hour, Dina Swanson, associate professor in the Warner School of Education at the University of Rochester, and Virtus Robinson is an assistant professor of history and African-American studies at Monroe Community College. This is Connections on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, first, New York State passed a film tax credit to lure Hollywood movie studios. Now lawmakers are floating a similar tax credit for musicians and recording studios designed to help keep artists in New York State. Who would benefit? What about the hardworking musicians in Rochester and the Finger Lakes trying to break through? We explore the new tax plan coming up next hour on Connections.
Millennial voters.
I have issues mostly with the two-party system.
I am scared for my economic future.
I'm more focused on social issues.
Overwhelmingly, millennials vote for Democrats.
When 66% of an age group votes for a particular political party, that's a big deal.
Will they keep voting that way in the future? That story later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to The Phones We Go and Jim in Rochester. Thanks for waiting, Jim. Go ahead.
Evan, good show. You just brought up the fact about the Washington Redskins, given the current situation they have about changing the name. But let's go back and look at a historical perspective. The previous owner of the Washington Redskins, George Preston Marshall, was the last owner to integrate his football team. He had no black players. Now, let's take Wellington Mirror, the previous who's passed on owner of the New York Giants when they played in the old Yankee Stadium up at the Bronx. His defensive line personified the United States of America. There was Jim Capcavage, the Slovak. There was Dick Mobutaleski, the Polish-American. There was Andy Robustelli, the Italian-American. There was Roosevelt Greer, the African-American. That personified America. And he understood that. And that's why they were always in the championship category, and they won several championship games. And what you just talked about, what this show is about, is the United States of America's DNA, and it's not going to change until there's a structural change, okay? And all I can say is people who understand, who embrace diversity, who like to take the best of the best, they're the ones who are going to be on the top. And the people who reject and want to stay closed-minded and want to continue to go back to 200 years ago when this country was coming along, they're going to lose out. I mean, that's the way it is. And history is replete with examples of that for thousands of years. So I'd like to hear your guest comment on that.
Thanks very much, Jim. Mm-hmm. Professor Swanson, you're first.
In terms of the implications of what this means for American DNA, mm-hmm. we draw on, to a large extent, the history of the country and how we identify ourselves as American citizens. So there are some things that are afforded to some groups that are not afforded to others, despite being a part of the same country. And so in terms of integrating and representing that, we can do far better than we have done and can do it with a very conscious effort, because that's what it's going to take. Without a conscious effort, we continue to rely on biases and stereotypes. But with a conscious effort, we can, in fact, do things very differently in impacting change over time.
Professor Robinson?
Yeah, is diversity having quotas? Saying, okay, make sure that you have at least one Polish-American on your team. And if you have a Polish-American team, do you have an Italian? Do you have a black person? But one group is left out. Those are the Native Americans. I didn't hear that there was a Native American player on that football team, and that's the team's name. So where are the Native Americans on the team? Yeah. Seriously.
If you're just joining us, the impetus for this conversation was the release of a new cookbook that has a website that gets tens of thousands of views a month. It's called Thug Kitchen, and it really gained popularity a couple of years ago. Some celebrities, including Gwyneth Paltrow, have pushed it. It's vegan recipes delivered with sort of an edge and a lot of profanity. Many people think it sort of appropriates kind of an African-American tone. And we never knew who the creators were until last week when they got ready for their book tour. And it's a white couple from Hollywood. They have said that they're meant no harm, but a lot of people are saying, look, that's cultural appropriation, and that's hurtful. Here's a statement that they released. I want to see if I can grab it. When they canceled an event because of protests in San Francisco at a bookstore, they wrote, "We love you, and we think you're all amazing in San Francisco. We were looking forward to meeting all of you and having a real conversation, but there are some who are looking to disrupt the event and create problems for these great local small businesses and small bookstores who were kind enough to partner with us on the launch, so we're holding off on our visit for now. Until we get back up there, we'll see you guys at our other stops." That's the statement from the white couple who created Thug Kitchen and responding to some of the backlash. Let's get back to the phones. This is Chris. Chris, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi. I think one of the things that people are overlooking here is the good that may have been done with this blog. The name Thug Kitchen, you know, it does have the connotation that might be associated with the black community, but at the same time, that will draw the black community into taking a look at this blog and maybe starting to use some of these recipes. When I think of a vegan recipe, which I know can be healthy, I think of the rich white family that goes to yoga classes, and I think along that stereotype. When I think of this blog, I think that, hey, maybe there's a bunch of people that normally don't cook vegan that can then start to learn this stuff, and it brings in the word thug, which is popular culture now, and it's made popular culture by the black community. So I don't think anyone should be worried about it so much as looking at what good actually came out of this.
Chris, thanks for the call. And before I let our guest respond, Chris's comments reminded me of a comment made one of the critics of Thug Kitchen is a writer online named Natalia Petrazelia. And Natalia writes this: "I'd love to see Davis and Holloway, the creators of Thug Kitchen, as well as the journalists who effuse over them, use their newfound celebrity to speak out about how troubling it is that health and wellness, social goods we might like to think of as human rights in an industrialized society, are so thoroughly perceived as luxurious perquisites that media sensations are made by capitalizing on the absurdity of imagining a poor black or homeless person eating quinoa, cooking tempeh, or indulging in a group exercise or self-help session." In other words, Natalia is saying the opposite, Chris, that the audience here is not the black community, and they may find this and they may think it's great. This is getting a laugh about the tone, that it's mostly people like Gwyneth Paltrow and a Rachel Ray audience who's checking this out, and that in reality, they're poking fun at the notion of, isn't it so funny that someone from that community would be eating quinoa? How hilarious. So, but how about this? How about Chris's point, Professor Swanson? Is it possible that Chris is on the money here, that maybe people will find it and maybe it will help people from impoverished communities think in new ways? I don't know.
I'm stepping out on a limb and saying, no, I don't think it is. And in part for a couple of reasons. One, that there's a level of profanity that's in the cookbook, that there's a part of this that for many in the African American community, I would suspect would not be something they would be drawn to for cooking purposes. The other has to do with just, I don't think that the audience that the authors were targeting was this community either. So I don't think African Americans are going to stumble upon it and try out the recipes. And nor do I think that was their target, the author's target audience.
Professor Robinson, you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to. I mean, it's a shame that they had to shut down some of cancel some of their events, because I think it's a great opportunity to open up a dialogue and talk to them about their reasons behind this and how did they come about this and, you know, where did they get their syntax from, where did they get their language from, and, and talk to them about their reasons behind it. I don't want to assume that, you know, that's why to target a new to get more African Americans to become vegan. I don't know if that was their goal. Then for one thing, the Thug Kitchen is only going to reach not even the majority of the black community. I'm sorry, a very small minority of the African American community is that's going to reach.
All right, let's get back to the phones and Tim in Pittsford. Tim, thanks for calling.
Hey, Evan. I want to go back to what your guests were saying about artists and their influences and profiting from that. There, as an example, there's a current guitar player. His name's Derek Trucks. He's great. He's one of the best in the world. He's white. And in interviews, you know, he'll list off his influences, and many of them are black. And he has covered many songs from black artists. He's paying homage to them. He's not stealing from them. He profits from it, but guess what? The person who created the song also profits from it. And for maybe some of us who have never heard of the person who created the song, now we have, which is a great thing because now we can purchase their music. So I don't get the whole, you know, if your influences are your influences, and I don't think it's stealing or degrading that person in any way, whether they're white or black. Like I said, they like that person. It's an homage to them. So I didn't really get that comment. Also, the whole tap dancing thing, you know, my three-year-old daughter tap dances, and if for some reason she goes to Juilliard and makes a living off doing that, which, let's be honest, she won't, but let's just say she does.
You can dream, Tim.
If she does, the last thing on my mind I'm going to be thinking is she ripped this off from the black community and this is a disgrace to them. I think that's just overdoing it. But maybe you could get a couple comments on.
Yeah, thanks, on that. Tim. Thanks for the call, Tim.
Yeah, the tap dancing comment was in reference to the belly dancing.
I don't think you were saying that white tap dancers are unfairly appropriating.
No. But in the past, that did happen, and I brought up Mr. Bojangles. Now that's not the case, because we have learned from that, and tap dancing didn't have That was a different case than what we're talking now.
Okay, but he's saying look, when Trucks plays music, it's an homage to the black creator of the song.
Right, he's doing it right.
And that is the point. He actually provides some of the history about and the impetus for the work he's doing. And so others are able to then go and hear the music that inspired him.
Right. Same thing with Rolling Stones, with Muddy Waters. I mean, that's why they're called Rolling Stones, because it was an homage to him and one of his songs that was called Rolling Stone. And so even before Muddy Waters died, they had concerts with him, and they had paid homage to him. Did they steal his music? Did they steal his style? No, they didn't steal. But they also, like the performer that he was referencing, gave homage to it, and that's the appropriate thing to do.
So you're saying that's paying homage, and even providing a financial opportunity for someone, honoring them in the appropriate way, as opposed to what you think with Thug Kitchen, which is only perpetuating a stereotype that hurts a community.
Correct.
Tim, I'm not agreeing or disagreeing. I'm just saying that I think that that's the difference that they are describing. Carvin, I think I know. Yes. Carvin, thanks for calling, Carvin.
Yes, I have a different take on this. And first of all, I really appreciate the conversation, and it's only through these kind of conversations that you can approach understanding. But American culture throughout the 20th century has always co-opted from the bottom of the culture, has taken from black artists, reformulated, and spit it back out as their own. The most recent example of that I could think of is this film on James Brown. And I can't remember the name of it, but movie critics and people love this film. Oh, it's so great. It's such a great interpretation of James Brown. I'm sorry, I beg to differ. The film was deplorable. The film opens with the scene of James Brown at the lowest point of his life, where he is portrayed as a thug, where he is menacing a group of white people with a gun. The toxicity of the image of a gun and James Brown have nothing to do with each other. If a black person had made that film, they may have included that idea, but they would have never opened a film about one of the most important artists of the 20th century with that imagery. So that imagery was created by and written by and produced by, of all people, Mick Jagger from the Rolling Stones, but for a purpose. So the purpose ends up distorting the image of James Brown, and then that's the image that people take away because there is no other image. So this issue of cultural appropriation, especially with respect to Black Americans, has a long and deep history that must be discussed, and it does happen. It has happened in dance. It has happened in music. It happens in fashion. It happens. It happens in language, right? The very use of the word, the reappropriation of the word thug, that is a complete co-opting of that from aspects of Black culture that many people would like to discard. So I'm happy for this conversation, but it should be put in perspective.
Carvin, as always, great to hear from you. That's Carvin Eisen, who's a local documentary producer. And let me ask our guest to respond. Go ahead, Professor Swanson.
Now, Carvin's actually absolutely correct in terms of the historical framework of these issues. And that is partly why we were really wanting to have this conversation, is to put it in the context that this has been going on, and at what point do we begin to change it? And having the conversation is a way of beginning to talk about how do we identify when this type of appropriation is occurring and begin then to redirect this energy in a way that does not continue to perpetuate stereotypes and biases that have a long history in this country.
Carvin, man, thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Okay, man.
We'll talk to you soon. That's Carvin Eisen, who you can actually see Carvin's work right now Carvin is working with the group at the Rochester, at ROCO, Rochester Contemporary Art Center, with Question Bridge, Black Males, absolutely worth your time. I would set aside 3 hours and go out there before the end of the middle of November when that exhibit runs out, which is sort of a separate conversation we've already had on this program, but I always appreciate hearing from Carvin. Here's an online comment. Said your earlier caller was wrong. Thug Kitchen does not target the Black community. It targets the college humor community, 20 to 30-year-olds. It works within the everything must be funny in order to grab attention preferences. Not sure if that was their intention, but that's where it's landed, and it's not for the Black community. So let's get a couple more calls in if we can. Dalton in Rochester. Dalton, go ahead.
There you go, Evan. My name is Dalton. I'm calling on behalf. I'm a member of the Banyan Tejada Nation of Acquisition, living here in Rochester, New York. Thank you for having this conversation on cultural appropriation, because right around this time, it's Halloween. We have the Redskins debate going on. Cultural appropriation is in the forefront of many Native minds right now. So I wanted to thank you for sort of having this conversation. I'd like to touch on three things. As a Native person, honor, homage, and history. I hear it all the time when people are debating about the Redskins or about dressing up as quote-unquote Native people or this idea of a Native person for Halloween, that they're honoring a vibrant history of Native presence here in America, when really what they're honoring is their own achievement of creating Native absence in America. The true history of this nation is one of dispossession, both territorial and corporeal. The term Redskin is a historical term given to bounties that were paid upon body parts, genitals, and scalps from massacres sponsored by the state, sponsored by governors of the West, for bands of settlers to go out and to return with these body parts. They would be paid to do the work of the state, which was settling this land. I hear a lot about, you know, the history of the name or the history of the team, and it's like, who gets to decide what side of the story we're telling? Because if you really want to talk about history, the real history is forgotten. And I think it was necessary to forget the real history for most of the quote-unquote American ideologies or American self-identities to be effective, to be present today, because you couldn't have a solid, proud American identity if you really knew what your forebears did to earn that right to exist. So I guess, and then I have a question just for the commentators.
Yeah, as quick as you can, Dalton, go.
Yeah, sorry. My question is, what do we as communities of color or as individual people of color do to positively respond? Because I personally have yelled, I've cried, I've tried to be reasonable, and nothing seems to get through. So what are your sort of strategies for engaging with this appropriately.
Dalton, thank you. We have less than a minute to solve that huge issue. So let's start with Professor Swanson. Go ahead.
One of the things to do is to acknowledge what kinds of strengths, what kind of positive attributes one's group has provided historically in mitigating some of the stereotypes. So it's one place to begin because we focus on mitigating the stereotypes, but we don't often simultaneously identify what are the positive things we want to be portrayed.
And Professor Robinson, how would you answer?
Well, what has been done is, you know, boycotting or not buying and not promoting this type of culture and sensitivity. But I appreciate his comments because there lies the real history, or a history that you don't hear that often, and if that was more brought out to people, then more people would not buy into it.
But to some degree, Professor Swanson has raised the point a couple times this hour. It is 2014, and we've got access to a lot of information. And if we want to wade in on cultural debates about names like the Redskins and things like that, we do have the resources to educate ourselves. It's about time we do it, don't you think?
Absolutely.
Thank you for educating us this hour. Professor Swanson from the University of Rochester, thank you so much. And Professor Robinson from MCC, nice to see you again.
Thank you.
And if you didn't get through on the line, we'll continue this theme in other ways, I promise, in upcoming days. And thank you for taking the time to weigh in with the program. Short break and much more next on Connections.